This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal, medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho, and here's where we talk with knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the programs and the people that try to help them. Today, we're going to talk about how we can have the life that we want, and the guest here is L.J. Mitchell. Well, good afternoon, L.J., glad to have you here. Good morning or good afternoon.
Thank you, thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, well, L.J., he's been about in this business. He's been in it longer than I have, actually. He was the owner and the founder, and he is the owner and the founder and past headmaster of the Greenbrier Academy for Girls, a college prep therapeutic boarding school in West Virginia. He's the founder and owner and director of the SUS Adolescent Program, founded it, was a co-founder in 1982, and founded the Aldridge Academy in 1999. All of these were wilderness therapy, therapeutic boarding schools, working with kids that are having behavioral problems. He is a pioneer in the development of wilderness therapy, and for the programs that he's been involved with, over 10,000 graduates. He's trained a lot of adolescent therapists in specific skills for changing unconscious beliefs. He has his doctorate in law and did additional graduate courses and studies in the behavioral sciences. He's a trainer's trainer in neurolinguistics and certified in brain spotting, extensive work with forensic psychiatrists and psychologists while serving as a JAG in the U.S. Air Force and practicing law in a civilian law firm. Other publications, he has a book, and it's called The Good Life, Decide Now, The Good Life or The Best Life. And he also a chapter in American Psychological Association textbook, and he's presented to the American Psychological Association. Been very busy, a lot of good credentials back there, and LJ. So, we're going to talk about The Good Life, The Best Life, and the book, Decide Now, The Best Life or The Good Life. And we're going to talk about, is the best life even possible? So, what do you mean by the best life, and how does it differ from the good life? Could you sort of start and give us a little bit of background of what you're talking about?
Well, after hearing that introduction, it makes me wonder if I've lived the best life. Made me tired just listening to it all. I'll try to distinguish the good life from the best life. A lot of people are looking for the proverbial good life. And I think most of us sort of refer to that as a life of feeling good, a life of having those things that give us pleasure. Sometimes if we imagine the good life, we might think of a deserted sandy beach somewhere, maybe an accomplishment, other things that make us feel good. Most of that kind of good life thinking is very self-oriented. The best life is really a step up. Best life.
Yeah, let me interject on the good life, because it sounds like a lot of those are physical: a house, home, nice car, sandy beach, plenty of money. It sounds like it's rather physical oriented.
Yeah, a lot of people would think of it as rather hedonistic, you know, physical pleasures. But it also could include, you know, accomplishments, ego, pride, playing to those making sure that we're the best, we're the top. Those are included in many people's good life as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I forgot to mention in the introduction, we do have a chat room if you're listening live on K4HD.com. There's a chat board there. You can click on that, ask questions or make comments, and we'll try to address them as we go through the hour. Okay, now, the best life.
Best life. Best life, as I'm proposing it, particularly in my book, Decide Now, The Good Life or The Best Life, is a step up in that it is a life that focuses on relationships more than just satisfying selfish interest. In other words, the quality of our relationships give us the best life. When we have the ability to give and receive love, compassion, virtues, it gives us the best life, no matter what our physical circumstances may be.
Okay, and so it doesn't preclude the good life.
No, it actually includes many of the elements of a good life. And certainly success and feeling good and having wonderful health and all those kinds of things enrich our lives. But what I'm saying is that the most important element is the quality of our relationships with everyone around us, but also, as I mentioned in my book, the parts within us.
Okay, so the relationships. Now, a lot of people might say, well, I have lots of relationships, but I think the quality of the relationships would be important, too. I think you're talking about really good quality, healthy relationships. Like the main unhealthy relationship is you might have a bunch of dope-smoking buddies, but that's not a good relationship.
Well, I think we can have all kinds of relationships, even relationships with enemies, that can be the best quality we can make them. You know, we don't have to go to lunch every day with our enemy or allow someone to have freedom to abuse us in any way, but we can have a relationship where we have respect, we can have compassion, we can even have, a form of love. It could be tough love in a relationship, even with our dope-smoking buddies. So we don't have to necessarily hang out with them and do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have a little bit of that. Now let's go to the next question I have is, how much say do we have on what our life will be? Because I know I run in, and I'm sure you've run into a lot of kids that says, well, that's just the way I am, and when their life is a mess. So how much say do we have in what our lives will be?
Well, that's a great question, and I certainly address that quite a bit in my book. I think most of us have heard the expression, accept me for who I am. And that assumption goes along with what you just said. Who I am is fixed. Some people think who I am is, you know, something that lives inside of them. You know, that my real self hides behind my liver or my kidneys. And to be happy, maybe someday I'll find my real self and let it express whatever it wants, and then I'll be happy. That is, you know, a fixed, deterministic kind of perspective, and it leads a little bit to fatalism. You know, people think they can't change. I've worked with tons of people who are stuck because they believe that fundamentally they are who they are, and they're not going to change, and nobody else is either. The best life presumes that we have choice. We have freedom to make particularly moral choices about what we value, how we respond in our relationships. That's not fixed. And that we can literally create who we are rather than just finding who we are.
So it sounds like we have a very extensive control over it. Very little is fixed, and a lot is based upon our choices, either conscious or subconscious. Is that correct?
Yes, in my book I even had a chapter that's called Are We Just Meat? And meat being just the corpus body, the physical self. And is our brain and our, you know, all the biochemical processes going on in our bodies, is that us? Is that the full extent of how we can make choices? you know, our bodies just responding or reacting to the environment around us.
Sounds like the classical Skinnerism of, you know, behavioral, you know, behavioral, we're a stimulus response mechanism, like, you know, a dog, Pavlov's dog.
Exactly.
Is that what you got in mind?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And certainly we do have a lot of stimulus responses, but the bottom line is that in many respects, we have choice, particularly these choices about what we value, what we love, and how we interact with other people in many respects. So it's to me, very damning to think that you can't change and that you're stuck. The problem is that most of who we think we are, our self-concept, is unconscious, and we don't know how to change it. You know, willpower and logic doesn't seem to change things. I've got lots of examples in my book, lots of stories in my life why that's mm-hmm. true.
Let me ask one other question, then we'll get into that. You touched on this, but you addressed a little bit more. Do we find ourselves or do we create ourselves? Let's really focus on that a little bit.
Okay. I think we all agree that we're born with certain abilities, characteristics, personality traits, and we have to work with those.
Okay,
however,
so we find those and limits and strengths and stuff. We find those.
Yes, absolutely. Now, as we move through life, though, we kind of make a decision on what we're going to really care about, and particularly who we believe we are, and our self-perception, our self-concept is critically important in having the best life or the good life. And what I mean by that is our self-concept, who we think we are, deep down inside. I mean, even in our deepest unconscious self, who we think we are is what gives us permission or motivation to do what we do or to say what we say. And it creates boundaries. There are limitations of what you will do or won't do as a result of who you think you are. Fortunately, as we move through life, since those perceptions are self-created, we weren't born with them, we can change them if we learn how to do so.
So where do they come from? Do they come from past experiences that you've long since forgotten, like some trauma when you were 2 or 10 or something like that? Or where do some of these things come from, these subconscious motivations you're talking about?
Well, obviously there's a lot of literature, a lot of research about, you know, the development of the self. And as we grow up, as we actually experience life, we do have experiences that sometimes are referred to as long-term potentiation experiences that create beliefs. We come to some perception about what something means. And when that is intensely sort of embedded into our minds, the neurology in our brain that creates that is different than other beliefs. It's stronger. It's thicker. There are more connections. And so it stays with us. And it doesn't necessarily have to be what is classically called a traumatic experience. But if it's intensely emotional to us and all these other brain elements I mentioned are involved, it does create that kind of deep level unconscious belief.
You
and
know, and you,
that's
you
what
made
we
a,
live with.
Yeah, you made a good point there that is not necessarily traumatic. I've run across, and I'm sure you have, several kids that some life-changing decision that they made was something that everybody had forgotten. No big deal. I remember one, and I think it comes from Seuss back in the early days that I heard about, that the kid at the age of 4, he was punished for something he didn't do, and he decided, oh, well, I'm going to show them, and he was a rebellious brat until he discovered that in some of the neuro-linguistic programming going on at Seuss. But that was something everybody had forgotten, but his subconscious had remembered it and really impacted his life. So it doesn't have to be necessarily something that people remember and very traumatic, right?
That's true. Let me give you another example. This is also in my book. Became aware of two cases, young women, teenagers, who were violently raped. And the results, the consequences for them were very different. One of them, before the rape, had a very low self-concept. Self-worth was minimal. And she didn't think she was very important in the world and struggled with that. After this rape, she became a full-blown whore, in her own words, and really despised herself and wished that she could be different, but she couldn't change it. The other girl who experienced a similar violent kind of rape, for some reason, had developed beliefs that she was really attractive and that people really liked her. And what happened in her case was that the rape itself validated her attractiveness. And so what she came out of that with was not that I'm a horrible person or I created this monster who hurt me, but it was, I'm so attractive, people can't keep their hands off me. And so her decision to fix the problem was to change her appearance. So she stopped wearing, you know, certain clothes, makeup, changed her hairstyle, and she was able to survive some of the other horrible elements, you know, that come with a rape experience. And I think the consequences were softened a great deal because of her self-concept that she was an attractive person.
So it's really important when something traumatic does happen, it's important in the state of mind. And I've seen several cases where something happens and somebody passes it off, no big deal, whereas it's devastating and the other person gets stuck in it. And so, I think what you're saying is that it's very important to know that. There's a pattern, I think, of therapists of something traumatic happened. Well, that's the problem. That's the reason the kids are doing it. And not necessarily so. Sometimes it's something fairly, would appear to be fairly innocuous.
Yeah, there's another example. I remember working with a young teenage boy who had a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties, certainly struggled with his self-concept and how he interacted with the world. But in working with him, discovered that when he was 4 years old, he went out on a little trek with his tricycle in his neighborhood. And he just kept riding along and block after block went by, and pretty soon he got lost. And it finally got dark. His parents were out looking for him. The police were out looking for him. And they finally found him. And he was in tears. So they took him home. Nothing had happened to him. He just got lost. Well, a belief had been formed. And the belief that was formed was the world is a dangerous place. And you can't even trust your parents to take care of you. And so he began to interact with the world as if the world's a dangerous place and that he was a victim. And that's really the belief that led him into a lot of the trouble and some of the emotional symptoms that plagued him.
Yeah, okay. And so that had to be sorted out later on. I presume that was one of your students at some point in one of your programs?
That's correct. Yes, and he couldn't change his self-concept without having some kind of a change in how he interpreted that belief. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the therapeutic interventions had to deal with that interpretation, bringing the past to the present and making it different. It wasn't just logic that allowed that to happen.
Okay. What personal experiences of yours led to your belief in the best life? So tell us a little bit about how your thinking has evolved over the years.
Well, I certainly, when I reflect on my life when I was a teenager, I was very committed to the good life, like many teenagers. You know, we laugh about drug, sex, and rock and roll, and so many people have followed that. When they're teenagers, it seemed like I tried just about everything to find out how to be happy. And a lot of it was, you know, looking to people who were older than me and thinking their experience and their maturity had given them the answers, and kind of led me into some painful difficulties and parties and alcohol and all kinds of things just weren't satisfying, just really weren't making me what I thought was happiness, mm-hmm. brought happiness to me. So I began to really search and think about it at an early age, and maybe other people can relate to that. And as life has moved on, I've had some significant experiences that have really affected me. In my early 30s, late 20s, was sort of on a fast track in the world of law. And then I got really sick, very, very ill. And I had four children, my wife. I became so ill I couldn't work. And this went on for weeks, and then months, and then years. And I remember wondering, you know, what is life about? How can you be happy when you're ill and you can't even do the things that you want or that you feel responsible for? Because I couldn't support my family. I couldn't be the hero that I had been to my children, at least in my mind. And so that was devastating. Mm-hmm. And my self-concept was really shaken. Through all of that, my wife was absolutely incredible. It was hard for her. There's no question. And she didn't relish in this, but she really loved me. And she helped me go through a lot of experiences that helped me understand that what was really important were our relationships, and that her love wasn't conditional on me making money or me being able to do the things I did before. And she had faith that I would get better, and it was constantly reinforcing that belief. And somehow in my mind, that helped me heal, and I overcame that. Unfortunately, a few years later, we were in an accident, and she was killed. I was almost killed, and all my bones, every bone in my face was broken, and I thought, wow, I was going to have brain damage, and I might have been blind. Anyway, here's this woman that meant so much to me, and she was gone. And I remember laying in my hospital bed, didn't want my kids to see me because my face was a huge balloon, and I wondered what life was going to be and what was there to live for. I had an experience where some kind of feeling came over me that the life that I had lived had taught me much, and that the people I had worked with to try to help them relieve some of the pain and difficulty in their lives, that had somehow been a little meaningful, and that my life wasn't done yet, and my children needed me, and other people needed me.
So those were the things that sort of kept you going and keeping an eye on the best life or the good life that you're going to be successful. And it sounds like your wife was the foundation from her experience was really important.
That was the relationship. I mean, you talk about communicating goodness and love and virtue that was infused in me because of her, not mm-hmm. because I think of myself.
So then what, you got over this, or what happened, and you continued thinking and exploring it, I presume?
Absolutely. And then intellectually, more and more, I began to explore the whole concept of the power of relationships. And Dr. Brent Slife, S-L-I-F-E, and I became friends, and he is the president editor of the American Psychological Association journal called the Journal of Philosophical and Theoretical Psychology. Brilliant guy. He's on, I think, five or six other editorial boards. And he had been writing about what I'd been trying to do with Seuss and Aldridge and all of the other efforts. And so we sort of began to collaborate. And more and more, the conceptual and the intellectual were coming together until it crystallized into what I now call the best life. And sometimes we call it strong relationality.
Okay. Okay, well, it's time for a quick break for an important announcement. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, talking with L.J. Mitchell, Is the Best Life Possible? And we've defined the best life, the good life, and some of the aspects, and then we'll get into how do you change an unhealthy self-concept or focus on that. We'll be right back in about 1 minute.
Saving Teens in Crisis Collaborative is a nonprofit organization that was formed in April of 2004 when parents of struggling teens realized that the help they were able to access for their child would prove to be prohibitively expensive for other struggling families. Saving Teens' mission is to assist troubled teens and their families struggling with substance abuse and other emotional issues. We work with the therapeutic program industry to fund and support families with financial limitations as they complete the comprehensive program that they desperately need but may not be able to afford. In partnership with programs, educational consultants, and the family, Saving Teens establishes a payment plan for services that include scholarship, family contribution, and Saving Teens funds. Our goal is to provide a total solution to troubled teens and their families with a methodology that incorporates financial and emotional support throughout a 12 to 24 month process of evaluation, intervention, and education. To donate or to get more information, please visit us at our website, www.savingteens.org. Thank you.
Well, welcome back. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report. Been talking with L.J. Mitchell. And we're talking about, is the best life possible? We've been defining the best life. And so let's go on the last half of this. Let's talk into how do you change an unhealthy self-concept? Because we designed a lot of this as subconscious. And a lot oftentimes, the person might know they have a problem, but they can't get at it. And they need some help. So how do you go about that?
Well, that's a great question. And the reason it's such a difficult question is because logic and conversation doesn't change self-concept. The core beliefs that we have really are very deep beliefs, and they're tucked away in our unconscious mind, deep in our brains. That's where the change has to take place. That's why, you know, a lot of therapy doesn't seem to work, or it's extremely slow. How do we change, really, what's going on in our unconscious mind when we're not even aware of it? And that's where I think three things come into place. First of all, I think as we move through life, our relationships, whether we structure them or aware of them or not, they change those self-concept beliefs, or they reinforce them. And so the people that we associate with have a tremendous effect on who we think we are. And we need to be somewhat thoughtful about, you know, who we want to be and the kind of people that we believe in or that we would like to emulate. They can have a tremendous impact on us. Although sometimes the very opposite kind of people that we want to be, we can have experiences with that reinforce, again, what we really want. So, relationships, number one. Number two, there are, I think, different kinds of cognitive mental experiences that people can have that can really bring out what's in the unconscious mind to a conscious awareness. And I spent a lot of time and effort to find out some of those approaches.
I would imagine one of the things in there would be just exposure to the wilderness, because you've done a lot of that, and that's an experience that gets right to the very basics of the person, you know, in touch with nature.
Yeah, the relationship with nature and being in a very vulnerable position in nature with very few resources really creates a tremendous, powerful relationship with the people in the group that would not necessarily be as powerful in other environments. In fact, a lot of the instructors or even some of the therapists and mentors who interact with troubled teens in a wilderness setting, those people would be totally ignored by those teens if they were back home where their environment was cool.
Isn't that something in the wilderness? Isn't that something that's similar to the bonding we hear about from people that have been in wars together in the platoons together?
That's a great example. And so the power of those relationships and examples and what happens in the adventure and perceived life and death circumstances can really affect people. In the wilderness, using some of these cognitive and some of these experiences in the use of our unconscious minds is a lot easier when people have a desire to want something more or different. And when we're humble and when we have tried everything we can to get what we want, but our old ways don't work, that's when people open up and want something different. In my book, I call that a desire to desire something different. The other way is through experiences that we might even choose. You mentioned one of them, these wilderness experiences, rites of passage in some indigenous cultures are powerful enough that they change self-concept. Religious experiences change people's self-concept. William James, the famous psychologist and political philosopher of the early 1900s, wrote a book. And in that book, about the experiences of that are religious in nature, from all walks of life and from many, many different countries, have a lot of common characteristics. And he really looks at the experience itself, not the beliefs or dogma of the religions, but the religious experiences, and talks about how the experiences change people psychologically, emotionally, and all the way to their self-concept. So that's another one. There are people who have tried to use drugs of various kinds to change their perceptions. And we have the ayahuasca culture down in the Amazon. And again, people are looking for experiences that would literally change some of the brain connections that we have and give us more choices about who we think we are. Some of those chemical kinds of experiences, though, are very, very dangerous. They have a lot of different kinds of side effects. I'm not necessarily recommending that.
No, but it does it somewhat. It was Timothy Leary was a big thing in the 60s,
that's right.
I think.
That's right.
That's right. What he was trying to do.
He's a contemporary person who certainly was looking at chemicals to help that process.
Okay. And then number three? You said there's three.
Well, there were three, and the three really are relationships, some of the therapeutic experiences, if they're well conducted by people who are really skilled, and then there are structured experiences that we can seek after. I mean, even, you know, the flow, high adrenaline experiences, people seek after those sometimes to give them a different perspective about life.
Like maybe climbing or high ropes courses or things like that?
Yeah, marathons, doing things that are dangerous and hard. And after going through the ardor of all of that, feeling like if I can do that, I can do anything, change who I am, what I can do in the world, what the world means to me, it attracts people, even though going through the experience is very painful.
Okay. Well, we have a couple questions on our chat function, and if you missed, if you're on listening to this live and you're on the website, k4hd.com, you can put in comments or questions. And a couple questions here is, what if, and you sort of touched on this, what if you don't recognize the problem, and what do you feel the kids from the stories brought to their lives? So those are two questions there. You want to tackle those?
Why don't you give them to me one at a time?
Okay, what if you don't recognize the problem? I presume the kid or the parents. What if you don't recognize they're a problem, but they, but they don't recognize it. I think in my mind's eye, the other kid, oh, everything's fine. If the parents would just get off my back, everything would be fine.
Right. Well, I think what's important to realize that I try to make available to people in my book is that even though you don't know what the specific belief is or self-concept, you can realize that the self-concept is probably involved in the problem. That there is an unconscious belief that's giving someone permission and motivation to act in some way. Everything from addictions to social interactions, anxieties, all kinds of feelings and experiences and engagements often have at the root some of these unconscious beliefs. And so finding someone who can help with those kinds of beliefs to find out if they are limiting is what I would strongly encourage that people do. You may not know what the belief is, but let me tell you, 80% of the time or more, in my mind, that's
I guess that would be the time where we say something, you need to get some professional help. Something's not going right, but the parents, the family, it's not going right. We need some professional help. That would probably be the time for that.
And not just professional help, but people who are good at this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
People who are not just processing what's going on in people's lives and discussing it and using a lot of logic, which can be very useful, and it can help pace people along and solve some problems. But ultimately, if you think you are a bad person, talking about how to be a good person, you can learn all kinds of things. But if that's your motivation and that's core, you're not going to change.
Yeah. Okay, the next question that they had was, what do you feel the kids from the stories brought to their lives? And maybe that's an extension of it, the two girls and the rapes. How did the parents deal with the rapes? So you can either handle together or one at a time. How did you feel the kids from the stories brought to their lives?
Well, I think, actually, if the experience is strong enough, it's going to affect their subconscious thoughts. You know, these experiences that are, quote, traumas or powerful enough to affect that part of their brain or that part of their mind where these self-concepts are kept. That's really what they bring to the table for change. And as I mentioned, in the two cases of the girls who were raped, their beliefs weren't changed. They simply were reinforced. The beliefs were already there. In one case, it just made one girl feel more worthless. The other girl felt more attractive.
So they brought what they brought to it was their self-image at the time.
That's right. Yes, they brought their self-image, their self-concept, their perceptual self, and the powerful experience either shook it up or reinforced it. And in those two cases, it reinforced it. To one girl's benefit and to the other girl's detriment.
Yeah. Okay, and the next question was, how did the parents deal with those rapes? Now, do you get any input in the parents and how they dealt with it or what they knew?
Well, I think when people go through traumatic experiences, we don't really know what's happening at a deep, unconscious, perceptual level. The best thing we can do is love those people. We need in every possible way to reinforce and to love them in a way that they can receive. And everybody receives love in a different way. Some people like affirmations. Some people like to have time spent with them. Some people like things, and gifts mean a lot to them. Finding out what it is that is a gift of love for a particular child. Not what we would want to give, but what they need. What is their love language? What is their love experience? I think that's the most important thing. And then to be very sensitive about whether or not they need some professional help as they struggle with that over time. And certainly if someone, doesn't respond over time and start, seeming to get better, that's a red flag. And they certainly need some kind of professional help to get through that. Sometimes for the little experiences like, you know, riding a tricycle, you don't even know. You know, you wouldn't even think of it. But you have to be, you know, sensitive that there are changes that occur in people's lives. And those changes don't happen for no reason. You know, if a child begins to act differently, something's going on. There is something happening that wasn't there before.
I would imagine a almost universal, of course it'd have to be sensitive, but almost universal would be a hug. That's something we don't do enough of, I think.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, that's very important, is a hug, a touch on the shoulder, you know, some reinforcement. I'm here for you, and I validate you. You know, those are important, and it indicates safety in many respects. Of course, you have to be careful with people that have been, you know, physically abused in some way or raped, because they may be desensitized to the meaning of a hug. As we would want them to interpret it.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're talking about, and generally about how do you change this unhealthy self-image or this self-concept in order to get towards the good life or best life. A couple of tools that have been very popular, and you mentioned when we talked earlier, empathy and mindfulness seems to be both in this. And could you, how that, and this is the person, the parents, the friends, the professionals, how would that be used to help? How would that fit into the mixture?
Well, to have the best life, to have the best relationships, quality relationships, is to know how to love someone else, what they need, not what you want to give them, what you just think they want. Empathy is having some kind of almost a sixth sense of knowing how a person is feeling. Sometimes that may be a reference to our own background and experience, but sometimes there is something else. There's some other kind of connection, some kind of energy between us and someone else. Mm-hmm. That can communicate a lot about what we need to do to love them, and it's very helpful to have empathy. It's also hard to hurt someone if you feel their pain. I mean, if you hurt someone and you're dissociated, you know, like a sociopath or a psychopath, then it's a lot easier to hurt someone because it doesn't hurt you. But if you're empathic and you feel what they feel, you're much more sensitive about what you say and how you treat people. So empathy, I think, is a tool that's necessary for us to have the best life and to share the best life.
So the empathy on the part of the person as well as those helping.
Absolutely. And of course, the person receiving the help may not be in a position to be as sensitive and empathic. And so for us that are reaching out to those in need, we're the ones that really need to be empathic.
Mm-hmm. To help them. I presume that the person that would be part of the best life would be develop empathy in themselves after they've gone through the healing.
And there are ways that you can actually increase your ability to have empathy. I mean, there are things that you can do with your mind that can make you more sensitive and to seek after the feelings of others rather than just your own.
Another thing is mindfulness is a tool that I've heard a lot of, meditation sometimes, isn't that? But is that one of the things that you use to help them is focus on mindfulness, getting them into present time?
Well, yeah, mindfulness is an ambiguous term. And when you say mindfulness is getting people into the present time, that can be very useful. However, we have to be careful. Because the future and the past does not exist except as we perceive it in the present. In other words, we have memories, but those memories aren't exact replicas of what actually happened. We select somehow in our minds what to remember about various experiences. And so, in the present, you know, if we discount all of our memories and are just aware of what's going on around us, there's not much meaning that we can associate with what happens around us without somehow connecting it to our perceptions of what happened in the past. It's the combination of the present and the past to give meaning to us. Same thing with the future. We have hopes, objectives, or fears about the future. And whatever we experience now, somehow we can project that into what it means in the future. And that can be very helpful. It can be very motivating, as well as it can be debilitating because of fear. So when we say we're mindful and we're only present-oriented, it's very difficult to do. And even when we are able to just be in the present, how we are experiencing the present is unconsciously affected by how we have perceived the future and the past.
That reminds me of a saying some people talk about our society and says, well, the future ain't what it used to be.
You know, that sounds like, I just read that the other day. Who was it that said that? Will Rogers or someone, and there's no question.
Yeah, I think it was Will Rogers.
Yogi Berra. I think it was Yogi Berra.
Or maybe both, but because it's been popular, I've heard it several times. Well, what do you think about it? What's that say to you?
What, the saying itself?
The saying itself.
Go ahead and restate it.
Okay, well, the saying itself, the future ain't what it used to be. What does that mean? What does it say? To me, it sounds like your expectations or your perspective of the kind of life you should live has changed. It's different now than it was when I was younger, things like that. We've just got a few minutes, and so let's sort of wrap up in this. It's sort of a little bit lighter subject while still being very serious.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the future ain't what it used to be, it's our perception of the future. And that means that whatever, like you said, our desires or expectations are, they've changed. And that can certainly happen when your self-concept changes. If who you mm-hmm. think you are has changed, then what you expect in the future is going to be really different.
And hopefully it's more healthy than the old expectation on that. Well, we have about less than 3 minutes. You have a couple of minutes. Could you want to talk about? We've been talking about the book, Decide Now, the Good Life or the Best Life, and which is available on Amazon.com and I think Borders, several other places. You want to talk a little bit about the book, what you're hoping to do with it, and then if you want to talk a little bit about Greenbrier, the therapeutic boarding school for girls, that's fine. You get about 2 minutes.
Well, the book really does address the question of the best life versus the good life. A lot of stories and a lot of quotes and concepts from various sources. It also talks about self-concept, how it's created, how we can change it, some of the difficulties and some of the conundrums about what that means to many people. And so I spent a couple of years doing quite a bit of research, reflecting on my experiences, and I hope the book is useful to help people change in a most fundamental, powerful, lasting way. It also is sort of a reflection of what we do at Greenbrier. We have a culture at Greenbrier called the Aspirations, and it's built on strong relationality, trying to help people embrace the quality of relationships as the core of their lives and the source of their happiness. And anything that gets in the way of that, we consider a therapeutic issue. And so no matter what it is, if it affects our ability to give and receive love, what we're all about at Greenbrier is having the tools necessary to remove those so that these young women and their families can have relationships of a higher quality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, they say we have 1 minute or less. We've been. This is Lon Woodbury of the Woodbury Report, and we've been talking with L.J. Mitchell. Is the best life possible? We've been talking about his book, Decide Now: The Good Life or the Best Life, and also talked a little bit about Greenbrier, where he's learned some of these things and put them together. Well, he learned them and then is applying them in Greenbrier. So I guess if you want to see the book in action, you'd go and look at Greenbrier. Thank you. Thank you very much, LJ. This has been very interesting and just got started. We could take another hour or two, I think, very easily. But thank you very much.
You bet. If people want to take a quick look at some of the book, I have a website, ljaymitchell.com, that has the foreword in the first chapter just to see, give a taste of what the book's about.
Okay, very good. Well, this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report. Been talking with L.J. Mitchell. And be sure to come back next week where we'll continue to talk about people working with struggling teens. Mm-hmm.